For this last chunk of time, we have the opportunity to bring some of our questions, just to commend all of you for the quality of questions. It's very good, thoughtful, insightful.
And by all of you, he means all of you, but two of you.
Right,
there was a couple. Who wrote the weird ones.
Right, there were a couple zingers in there. Just a few. A few zingers, but mostly really, really good questions, very thoughtful questions. But before we even dive into some of the Q&A, just to encourage you brothers, you know, as rich and as good as it's been to have Dr. Rigney, and even here at this last session, to hear some of his answers to some important questions, I think it's a critical part of this is for you to be able to say, how would I answer that question? I think as Christian men, we need to be sharp enough with the scriptures. We need to be growing in the truths of God to be able to answer complex, controversial questions with truth, you know, with courage, with clarity. So just encourage you, as we're even talking through these questions, how would you answer it? And how can I grow? And the Lord gives wisdom. He richly supplies his truth and wisdom. As we put our noses deep into our Bibles, we open our hearts to God in prayer and ask for his help to grow, he's going to cause you to grow so that you can also walk in the truth. So, in no particular order, I'm just going to start asking questions, firing away. And he's in real quick fashion just going to fire off because there's 600 questions here.
Sweet.
I'm kidding. You can linger on any question you feel like it. So, first question. Brilliant question. Here we go. I didn't write this. Doug Wilson, Charlie Kirk, and yourself are all constantly dismissed due to bad tone. How do we combat this tone policing while also not dismissing the role of tone? And specifically in spousal arguments like you mentioned earlier.
Oh, spousal arguments. Okay, good. So actually, that's one of the ways you can measure it. So start with the spousal thing. Part of the tone thing, like for Doug, has been the serrated edge. And so there's a Bible study question to this. Does the Bible speak sharply? And does the Bible tell you that there's a time to speak sharply? And the answer to that is yes. In Titus, I think it's Titus or 2 Timothy, rebuke them sharply. And then you go, okay, what does that mean? How do I know what a sharp rebuke is? It's like, well, you have the prophets, you have Elijah, you have Jesus with the Pharisees, you have Paul with the Judaizers. When it comes to actual sharp speech, the Bible, it's not just like every once in a while. It's like there's entire books of the Bible devoted to just unloading on sin and folly. So that's the permissibility. Question. Is this a biblical way of speaking? Yes. And oftentimes, my experience has been evangelicals are enough of biblicists to be like, yeah, in principle, it's fine. And then after that, it's like, but I don't like the way you do it. And then at that point, it's like, that's okay. You don't have to. That's okay. I'm not worried about it. So I used to spend a lot of time, this was when I was in Bethlehem circles, I ran into this a lot because I was friends with Doug. Where Doug would say things, and then I would have to explain to others that. And I think there's a role for that. I still do that some. I feel less, now I see the wisdom of there's a place for explanations, but it's easy to get bogged down. Because there are people who, it seems like they're asking a question, but what they're actually doing is trying to hold you back. Right? And it's a form of sabotage. They're deliberately misunderstanding. And so at some point it's just fine to be like, we just disagree. That's okay. I'm good. And it's not going to slow me down. So, but one of the things that Doug says about the practice of like satire and serrated edge type stuff, sharp speech, is that the biblical satirist, a person who's going to use this kind of speech, which isn't everybody's calling, by the way, okay. This is true of a lot of like that kind of stuff. Even in the book of Acts, most lay people, like the Christian boldness piece, like you may be called in different contexts, everybody's going to be called to be bold at some level, right? But it's important to that, like it's Paul and Peter and Stephen, it's the leaders that are called to be the bold ones in public where the pressure's on. What's the call of the lay people? And the call of the lay people is just to say amen and to pray for them, right? Pray for your pastor and when they say the hard thing, to go amen. That's your call. It's not the onus isn't on you to be the one. But one of the things Doug says about a godly satirist is his family should never flinch when he comes in the room. Meaning, he knows this sort of speech is to be used in certain contexts, and not in others. So sharp speech in an argument with your wife is a sin. Okay, because it's probably in that context coming from anger, frustration, bitterness, and a desire to, you're jabbing. And so that's a sin because your heart's wrong. But in a public controversy where you get a zinger, or you uncork or you mock or whatever, there it's deliberate. You're trying to show sin to be folly. And it's on a dimmer switch, even in public. So there's playful jabs. It's like there's a time for kind of like it's a correction, but it's a playful one. It's like, hey, knock that off. And then there's the you sons of hell, right? I'll just underscore one little thing on this from this book of Acts again. There's a great scene, I want to say, where is it? Acts, is it probably 13 or 14. It's when Paul is trying to preach to the governor, Sergius Paulus, and there's a soothsayer in his court named, what's his name? Elymas, the magician, Elymas. And Elymas tries to dissuade him because he's going to lose his money. If this guy becomes a Christian, he's not going to be able to, he's not going to pay Elymas to predict the future anymore. And so he tries to get in the way of Paul preaching the gospel, and it says, Paul, filled with the Holy Spirit, said, you son of the devil, you enemy of all righteousness, why are you trying to make crooked the straight path of the Lord? Like, God put me here and gave me a straight path, and I just want to underscore, it's like fruit of the Spirit. It's like insult, sharp words, pointed words. In that context, that's what the Spirit bore. It's very clear, full of the Spirit, Paul said this. And so if you don't have a category for that, or somebody else doesn't, they have to get it. And if they don't, I don't think you shouldn't spend time feeling like, just okay, we disagree. A lot of times with this Moscow question where this comes up, some of it's just vibes. Like, it's just people don't like, it feels funny to them, feels off to them, or it's taste, it's preference. And the challenge is that they moralize their tastes. It's like someone who said, I like chocolate ice cream and you like vanilla ice cream, and this is a moral question. And at that point, it's just like, okay, that's okay. You don't have to, it's your preference, it's fine. But it's not going to slow me down.
Follow up to that. 2 Timothy 2:25 instructs us to be gentle with our opponents with hopes that they will repent.
Yeah.
But Galatians 6, Paul writes his opponents would emasculate themselves. And in 1 Corinthians 16, he curses those who do not love the Lord Jesus. Yep. So help us reconcile.
Yeah, good. So so there's two options here, I think. And I have one that I incline towards. One is, you could say, yep, you're always, every time you speak to an opponent, it needs to be done with, so the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, able to teach, patiently instructing others, correcting his opponents with gentleness in order that God may perhaps grant repentance so they can escape the devil. So it's, every word needs to be with gentleness. And if you go that way and you say that's all universally true in every context, then you have to say, and apparently, gentle speech includes you son of the devil, you brood of vipers, you hypocrites. Like that the Bible classifies that as gentle speech. That's one option. I don't take that option. I think that this is I think the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, has in view when you're correcting with gentleness to people who are, you're actually in a debate, in a discussion where you're winning them, okay, which is different than when you're in a public debate or you're calling out the magistrates or the governing authorities for something evil, and you're saying, you son of the devil. The goal there is not correct them to bring them back. The goal there is to speak the truth and then leave it in God's hands entirely, right? And so I don't think that, in other words, it's possible that gentle speech includes the harsh speech. I just think that's a little weird. Instead, I think there's context where the gentle speech is appropriate and there's context where rebuke them sharply is appropriate. So there's correct with gentleness, rebuke them sharply are both commands, and it's wisdom to know which situation is this. I think the common, or the category I use to distinguish is, this is a Wilson category, apostles from the world and refugees from the world. So apostles from the world are those who are trying to, they're leaders, that's Pharisees. That's Pharisaical, that's Elymas. These are leaders trying to prevent the gospel from going forth. And with apostles from the world, there's a place for uncorking. With refugees, they're the ones who have maybe imbibed it. They've listened to those apostles. They think that way, but they're persuadable. They're the collateral damage. And with them, I do think there's a role for it's more the correct with gentleness. How did Jesus talk to tax collectors and sinners? That's different modes of speech. But Christian rhetoric is actually it's more complex, and our desire is often to just flatten everything. And in doing so, what we're effectively doing is we're saying this part of the Bible mutes that part of the Bible. This part of the Bible, this verse right here, trumps that verse. And you should never do that.
That's very good. Yeah, it breaks the mind that what Proverbs 24, answer a fool according to his folly. Or don't answer the fool according to his folly. I would talk about flattening if we don't have those two. All right, another one, totally different subject here. Does the New Testament teach the church to influence culture and government as a mission or just preach Christ?
Yeah, so I would not dichotomize those. It's not an either or. Because part of what is preaching Christ? Why are we preaching Christ? Because Jesus said, go make disciples of all nations, baptizing them and teaching them to do everything I said. So the teaching them to do everything I said means everything he said everywhere. So all authority in heaven on earth is his. So disciple the nations and teach them everything means everywhere. There's not a square inch that's not touched by that command. So that means that you're going to have to get into the culture and the politics and the homemaking and everything else. Like, what does obedience to Jesus look like here and here and here and here? I think it's baked into the Great Commission. And it's folks who are wanting to narrow that to know preach the gospel just means get people saved. Fulfill the Great Commission just means narrowly get them to confess Christ and then leave it there. They're the ones who are, I think, misusing that. The other thing that's interesting, because people will often say, you know, Old Testament has all this stuff about nations and how, you know, Israel's governed and all of these different scenarios that you can point to, like Ezra and Nehemiah today. The New Testament doesn't do that. They're in a pagan context. But if you notice, like half of the book of Acts is Paul trying to get in front of Caesar. Like, even after he could get off, like he appeals to Caesar and he's like working his way up the appeals process, basically, like Governor Festus, Governor Felix, King Agrippa. Like he's just in front of all of the Roman centurion. Tribune. He's just working his way up in Acts 20, 21 to 25. And at every level, they're like, this guy could go home, but he appealed to Caesar. And Paul's like, yeah, I'm going to get in front of the emperor of the world. And what do you think he's going to do when he's in front of the emperor of the world? The same thing he's doing in front of all of the lesser magistrates, right? What does he do in front of Festus and Felix? Festus is like, Paul, you're trying to persuade me to become a Christian. And he's like, I am trying to persuade you to become a Christian. I wish everybody was like me except for the chains. But he's in prison and he's preaching to magistrates about sin, about righteousness, and about judgment, self-control. He's preaching the word to them. Why? So that they'll become Christians, they'll be saved personally, individually. And then what is he going to tell them next? Okay, Paul, now I'm a Christian. And he's going to say, great, you need to obey everything Jesus said in your role as a magistrate. Everything he said. So acknowledging him, where'd that sword? You have a sword, Festus. Where does it come from? It comes from God. Wield it well. Punish the righteous. Punish the wicked. Reward the righteous. Don't invert it. Always a temptation for the government. So it's going to be that. So I think the New Testament is there's no gap on this question of the states or cultural application between old and new. There's complete continuity. And that's why the Bible can say whatever was written in former days was written for our instruction. That stuff was written to instruct you, not just how to instruct Israel in the 6th century BC. No, it's for you.
Very good. Yeah, coming from that, how do you reconcile Christian nationalism to build and fight with 1 Thessalonians 4, 11 through 12, which is to aspire to live quietly?
Yeah, good. So I think you should aspire to live quietly, like the early church in Acts did. I think that's what do they do in the book of Acts? They're trying to live quiet. We want to worship God. We want to do this, and it just brings them into a collision with the authorities aren't going to let you. Everyone who desires to live a godly life will be persecuted. Everyone, right? That's what the Bible, they're going to hate you. The world's going to hate you. Your everything about what you believe is offensive. And so you should aspire to live godly lives. You should pray for that. And then when you can't, Peter says, don't be surprised when the fiery trial comes upon you to test you. So aspiration, yes. But that also means, when you pray, Lord, we want to live quiet lives. Paul does this in 1 Timothy 2. He says, I urge that everyone, prayers be made for all people, kings and those in authorities, so that we can live those quiet lives. The idea there is that the state exists to promote social order, law and order, right? Law and order, so that the church can get on with its business. Evangelizing, helping, serving, families can be families, churches can be churches, and the state's job is to maintain order. And so it puts you on a collision course when the state decides that's not our job. Our job is to promote disorder and to make obedience to God hard and to persecute the righteous. And then then you got to obey God, not man, and you're not living quietly. But it's like another example. This is in Elijah when we just want to live quiet lives and worship Yahweh. And Ahab's like, oh, is it you, you troubler of Israel? You troubler. And Elijah's response is, I'm not the one who's troubling Israel. Your idolatry, Ahab, your immorality, your oppression, your injustice, that's what's troubling Israel. I'm just the one pointing out the trouble. I'm just drawing attention to the trouble that your evil is causing. And this is actually a major point about this. This is broader about the sabotage thing. Oftentimes, this is true, big sabotage, national sorts, Christian nationalist sort of stuff. It's true in your family. Oftentimes, the person who refuses to go along with the folly, refuses to just kind of slide with the crowd, will be accused of causing the problem when actually they're bringing the problem to light. This is really, and you have to get used to this. Like, in other words, they'll say, you caused this, and you have to, if you didn't, you have to say, no, all I did is not move. I just didn't move. Everybody else was moving, I didn't move, and so now that caused the blow-up. I was the occasion for the flare-up, but I wasn't the cause. The cause of the flare-up was that person popping off, that person, their passions getting the better of them. But I'm not going to take responsibility for what they did. Does that make sense? In the sense of, like, I'm not going to take the blame if someone else blows up because I didn't move, because I spoke the truth. You'll find this in Christian context, we'll do this sometimes. It's called negotiated apologies. Or apologies as a negotiating tactic. Okay. So yes, Susan shouldn't have called you a hateful bigot in that meeting. But you can see how the fact that you said that, maybe you had offended her. And it's like, well, I can see it, like I was there. But what I said was true, and I wasn't, so the expectation is she'll apologize for this if you apologize for that. Does that make sense? You apologize for this, I'll apologize. Now, if you did sin, there shouldn't be any question. You don't even have to wait for her. Or him or whoever. You just own it sincerely before God. I was wrong. I lost my temper, whatever. But if you didn't sin, it's a sin to apologize. Got that? Like, this is actually really important. This is here's a fun story. Just see what you like. Keep them short. Yeah, right. Okay, so here's fun. Here's a fun story. This is a Nate Wilson story. Nate was a best man or a groomsman in a wedding, and they're at the night before the wedding. There, it's like the bachelor party, and it's a Christian bachelor party, so it's just guys hanging out. But the father of the bride's there, and her brothers and different things like that. And they're going around talking, and they start giving advice to the groom. And so everybody's giving him advice, and it comes time, and the father of the bride looks at his future son-in-law and says, hey, I've been married for 25 years, and I've learned a lot about marriage, and it's great. And he says something like, there are going to be times in your marriage where you didn't do anything wrong, but your wife thinks you did. And in those moments, you need to value her as a person and value the relationship with her more than your own pride, and you should just apologize. You should apologize. Okay, and so he gives that advice, and then Nate's next, and Nate says, okay, so there's going to be times in your marriage when you sin against your wife, and when you do, you should own it straight up, no chaser, no excuses, no blame shifting. You sin, repent of it, and you should seek her forgiveness. There's going to be other times in marriage where she thinks you sinned and you don't think you sinned. In those cases, you should absolutely never apologize to your wife. In fact, it would be a sin, because it's a sin to lie to your wife. So that's, and that's, you know, and you can just feel the like, kind of in your bones, but it's like, why? Like, don't you think it's wrong to lie? Isn't lying wrong? So if you don't think you sinned, and if God doesn't think you sinned, why would you pretend that you sinned? It's a sin to invent sins. So don't invent sins. That has applications all over the place when you have this attempt to say, well, he'll apologize for this if you apologize for that. Well, if that isn't a sin, you may not. And then you're going to be, well, why aren't you being humble? Why aren't you, you know, like you're going to get all the names, and it's just you've got to be able to, it's cupcake time.
It's cupcake time. All right. How do we interact with Christian family, and the Christians in scare quotes here, Christian family who have become blinded by the world's creed or thinking? Should we argue through the issues?
It depends. I can imagine families where it would be a real fun time around the dinner table to say, like, what do you think? And I think that's where the curiosity thing, if you're sober-minded, get curious, try to understand where they're coming from, try to address it. I think there's a total place for that. I think a key thing in it is what I said about assuming the center. So maybe I'll just double-click on what assume the center means. Assume the center means that you act as though you believe what you believe in terms of how you carry yourself. And if you're trying to go, what do you mean? Well, there's a way in which evangelicals often adopt the framing of their opponents, right, and are apologetic, not in like the apologetics, like defend the faith sense, but like, I'm sorry, because they've sort of imbibed the opponent's frame and they're adapting to it. There's a little bit of a defensive crouch. So it's the sort of thing where it's the preacher who's going to preach about wives submit to your husbands and apologize for it, because he knows he's got feminists in his audience. And so he's going to be like, ladies, I know this is really hard. I'm so sorry. But God says that you kind of have to submit to your husband. Sorry. Don't kill the messenger, right? There's that vibe that's given off. What you've done is you basically said you've assumed the center as feminism, and you're trying to kind of like ride the brake a little bit. The opposite is just acting like what you believe to be true from the Bible is true and is good for everybody. So it's like, wives, submit to your husbands. Not always easy, but it's really good. You should do it. You just assume the center there. So when you're discussing with squishy family members, Christians who've imbibed the world, you should just, sometimes it can be really fun. I remember one time I was debating with some Christians like this recently on a podcast who didn't like my stuff on empathy. And they were trying to be like, well, you know, the Trump administration has done X, Y, Z, and that's just as bad as the left on abortion. And I was just like, that's crazy. That's just crazy town, guys. Like, I wasn't mad, but they were trying to like be, can you at least admit that this is equally bad? And I was like, no, it's not even close. Like, they're not in the same moral, the intentional murder of an unborn child and cutting off aid to foreign nations that might lead down the road to like potential starvation or whatever, like there's just aren't even in the same category. Could the aid be good? It might be, but maybe it's a slush fund for leftists. I have no idea. Like, I've not studied that. But this one's super clear, and I'm not going to pretend like, well, let's both sides it. That's assuming the center. Another good example of this. Remember a couple years ago, I think I wrote an article on this one, Harrison Butker, remember the kicker for the Kansas City Chiefs? And there was that time, he's a Catholic, and he went and spoke for like at a graduation for some small Catholic college in Nebraska or something like that. And his message is basically like, be a good husband and be a good wife. And he used his wife as an example. And in the passing, he like mentioned pride and sin. It's a little shot at the LGBT. And then he used his wife as an example of like, my wife, just she wants to be a wife and a mother, and you should be like her, ladies. And he's speaking to a Catholic, conservative Catholic audience, and is like it's the most normal thing. And like the NFL had to like come out and be like, Harrison Butker does not speak for us. And you're just like, did anybody think he did? Was that like, were there people who were like, did Harrison Butker is the spokesman for the NFL now? And like the city council of Kansas City is distancing and denouncing him. It's just so bizarre. The reason they did is because it wasn't just that he said the truth, no true things. It was that he said the truth as though it was the most normal thing in the world. This is what Paul means by open statement of the truth. Not cunning, not trying to like navigate all the things so that nobody gets offended. It's just matter of fact, this is true. And so I think if you're going to discuss with family members this, that should be your demeanor. you should just believe it down to your bones and be like, well, yeah, of course this is, you don't think this? You don't, like, this seems very obvious to me. That should be your demeanor internally, and then have the discussion.
Any books in the works?
Okay, so there's always books on, like, back burners that sometimes get, like, shoved to the front. That's how a lot of the books get written, actually, is like, now's the time, go. The one that's actively somewhat in the works is I've got a 5 views book on Christian nationalism. So I've got one of the chapters in that. We've got 4 other authors. That's probably going to come out later this year if we get everybody in. So we everybody's written their chapters. Now we get to respond to each other. So that's coming out, different perspectives from, it's all Christians, but debating from that from different sides. So 5 views, Christian Nations. What else? Back burner stuff that's, I hope we'll get to the front at some point is there's a little book on Puddleglum, Puddleglum's faith, that's kind of, I've done lectures on and it's just there, and it's going to take time to, like, wrestle it and get it out. I've got a book
Who's
on
Puddleglum, for those who don't
know. Puddleglum from Narnia, like, that puts his foot in the fire in that famous scene in Narnia. I think it's basically an exposition of those, like, 5 pages, just those 5 pages about, like, this is the modern world that he's engaging with. So Puddleglum's faith, crisis of faith in modernity, things like that. What else? Book on Shakespeare. So there's Shakespeare has these plays that I call the jealousy plays. It's the same story 3 different times. It's actually 4. There's 2 versions of it that are romances, but it's 3. It's the same basic story, but there's a comic version of it called Much Ado About Nothing. There's a tragic version of it called Othello. And then there's 2 romance, which are tragic comedies. They have both sad stuff and funny stuff. They end the happy endings. Comedies end happily. Tragedies end with bodies on everywhere. And then tragic comedies have bodies, but then things turn out well. And Winter's Tale is the 3rd. And it's the same story. It's a jealous husband who becomes falsely convinced that his wife has cheated on him. And it's just a fascinating subject. I've taught Shakespeare for years, so I've got that. That's 95% done, probably. And it just needs, like, a little bit of something to get it over the edge. Those are, I think, the big ones.
All right. That's a good answer.
Here's an interesting one. What's the story behind the cover of your book, Leadership and Emotional Sabotage? Little monster with teeth.
Canon did that. That was all them. I just wrote the book. I did the lectures for Canon, and then I was like, hey, I've wrote these lectures, and if I added another, you know, filled out each chapter a little bit more, that's a little book. They're like, great, go for it. And then they sent the cover, and it's got this monster at the top, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. And in talking to them, basically the idea is that most leadership books that you see are all going to be very buttoned up and polished, okay? And so the bottom of the book has that kind of polished look, and then at the top, there's the monster, we call him sabotage. Like, sabotage, like peeking up, and that's actually often how sabotage works, is it's outwardly very respectable and polished, but is trying to, you know, derail you and get you off. So that was the thought. So that's where the sabotage monster, so yeah, sabotage, and then when they decided to do empathy, they made the little powder puff guy with the bomb. So empathy is this nice little thing with a little bomb that's going to destroy everything if you let it run everything.
That's excellent, yeah.
Since male headship is rooted in God's created order, how should we view females in positions of authority in other spheres, such as government, business, and education?
Yeah. So I think husband's the head of the home. That's a non-negotiable. Pastors are head of the church and must be qualified men, also a non-negotiable. God guards the garden, the sanctuary. God's the worship of the church. He insists. As you work out from there, I would say male leadership is normative, meaning it's normal. It's normal and in a society that's obeying in those areas, the norm will be men are the heads of all the stuff, and that's normal. But there would be places for kind of exceptions. It's not the same because often, effectively, what happens. This is just my take on like how nations work now. Basically, in the same way that like you're the head of the household, and you're the domain of your household is expanding as you're, you know, you got a competent wife. That Proverbs 31 woman. I think Chris Wiley said it this way. He's like, if you took the Proverbs 31 woman and you plopped her down in the 21st century. She would be the vice president of a mid-sized corporation, family-owned, right? If you look at what she's doing, she's buying real estate. She's got servants doing stuff. She's overseeing them. She's working hard. She's not the boss. She's not the CEO. That's her. But she's a queen, for goodness sake, right? This is a prince going to be a king, and this is the queen. So she's over stuff, but she's under her husband. And so that principle that, you know, the husband's the king of the kingdom, but she's the queen, and that means that she's in charge of things and executes on that, is a totally biblical vision in that context, which means that as you work out into like a business context, I think that there's ways that those are large households, those function like households. And so is there roles for women in there? Yes. The problem is that modern industry, modern business requires women to stop being women in order to do it. Right? So we got to, this is, got to get them on the pill, got to make sure abortion's available so that they can compete with men because it has to be equal. And so that's a denial of their femininity. So the general thing is a woman's priority is her home, not a woman's place is only in the home, because the Proverbs 31 woman is going and buying real estate. So having said all that, I think it would be normal. And then in the modern context, when you have just the chaos and high-handed disorder that we have, I think, how to put this? So basically, in normal circumstances, who's governing and who's guarding the city? Who's at the city gates? Men are. What happens if the barbarians have already breached the gates and they're running around burning everything? And then I look over and I see, here's a godly woman with her frying pan, like beating one of the orcs. Yeah, I'm not going to be like, hey, that's a man's job. Does that make sense? So I've got a place in the chaos of the present moment for just, you know, who's on team not barbarian, who's on team and who's anti-orc. Let's work together. But I think a healthy society, you wouldn't have that. Like a healthy society, it would be normal, and nobody would care. Like that's the big thing that I think we're modern, like the modern world, secular world, feminist world, is this impression that if an industry or a vocation is dominated by men, that there's a problem. And I don't think, and that's part of assuming the center. You should, when somebody says, hey, you know that in this role, like, did you know that 80% of the people in that job are men? And they say it like, can you believe that? You should be like, cool. Sounds awesome. Right? Like, you should just, like, it should not, there should be no angst about that. And I think in a healthy, godly society, women would be very busy fulfilling their calling as wives and mothers and household managers. And they would be, it would be great. And men would be out doing the city gate stuff.
Good, excellent. All right. Similar concern here. What do you make of the egalitarian argument that Eve was pulled from Adam's side to symbolize that she is equal to him in every respect, including in leadership responsibilities?
Yeah, so I think this is, that could be possible if you just had the story. That could be the case, but we don't just have the story. We also have the commentary on the story that Paul gives us, and the commentary is she was from him and for him, he's not for her. There's an asymmetry in them, and so I think, again, like I said last night, common human nature is why she's from his side, but she's derivative, she's secondary, and you hear derivative, and sometimes people get this and they think like that means lesser. The later is lesser. And it's like, that's not the biblical way of thinking. She's the glory. He's head, she's glory. Right? Because she's the glory of man. So that's how Paul in 1 Corinthians 11 talks. Like, man is the glory of God. She's the glory of man. And we think, oh, she's only the glory of man? It's like, that means she's the glory of the glory. She's the glory of the glory. That's the most glory. Right? And so... this is, again, men build structures, make things, enlarge dominion, guard and protect, and then women bring life. They make things glorious. They beautify. That's how it works. That's not a downgrade. It's just they're different. And so Paul tells us what Adam and Eve's origin means. He doesn't leave us in the dark.
Good. That's excellent. Yeah. All right, here's a more pastoral question. How do you begin to operate as a headship household when it has been inconsistent or completely lacking?
So if you're the head, and I take that's I've been failing, I've totally blown it, Okay, so the first thing you need to do is own that before God. This is where you're going to get before God and say, Lord, my household is a mess, and it's on me because I've not taken the initiative. I've not taken responsibility. So, Lord, this is me acknowledging my sin and my abdication and my blame shifting, and I'm stopping that today. I'm taking responsibility. Lord, this is mine. And then if it's sufficiently bad, it probably means going to your wife, maybe your kids, and saying, hey, Dad's not got this done. Dad's, I've failed in this way, and I'm rebooting. This is a reset now. I'm going to take initiative, and I want you guys to know that. I'm wrong. Please forgive me, and now I'm going to take initiative to do it. And you're going to, and I would say you would pick a few things, not 100 things, not even 10 things. You would pick like two or three things as basically training wheels, okay? And that would, I think it would start with making sure you're attending worship and leading your family in corporate worship at church. That, like, this is what we do, and I'm there, and I'm engaged, and I'm leading my family to the throne. It would include prayer with your family, things like that. And then you would pick one or two other places where, you know, we're going to pray at dinner and Dad's going to pray if you've not done that. Or whatever, if there's big places where you've just botched it, you should say, I'm going to do that. And then press forward and then add to the list. As your muscles get stronger, you can do more. But always going back to the Lord and saying, I'm taking responsibility. I know this is mine. And then if you get stuck, you get help. You don't just suffer alone and be like, I don't know what to do. There's a lot of guys, I'd be like, I put myself in this category. I grew up in a home where my dad loved me. He was a professing Christian, became a more serious Christian later in his life. But I did not grow up in a home where, like, I had any models of, like, what spiritual leadership. He coached my baseball team and was affectionate to me and my brothers, and, like, that was all good. Like, I never, so all kinds of blessing for my dad in that regard. But just spiritually had he didn't have it. And so he's just figuring it out late. And so by the time I was in high school, I was more spiritually interested and had surpassed him. You know what I mean? Like, it was just a hard thing. And so, like, I remember it was difficulty, like, how to do that. So that means when I started my family, it's like, I have no muscles for this. I don't have no lived experience of what this means. So what am I doing? I'm asking people. I'm talking. I'm listening very carefully. I'm listening to how, say, Pastor Wilson, I learned most of my marriage and parenting from him, and I'm listening to what he says, and I'm like, okay. And the way, what helped me here was that multi-generational piece. Thinking generationally. So if you come from a home like I did, where you didn't have good models from your parents in certain ways, maybe they weren't even Christians, and now here you are and you feel like you've been thrown into the deep end, right? And there's that old Jim Gaffigan quote. It's like what's it like having five kids? Well, it's like you're drowning and then someone throws you a baby, and like you feel that you're like I'm drowning and then all of a sudden I have this responsibility. How you should think about that is multi-generationally, meaning. There's things that are really hard for me and that I feel like really awkward doing that I'm aiming so that when my kids are in my spot, it doesn't feel awkward. To them, it feels normal. Of course we do that. So you feel the awkwardness because you didn't have it and you're training wheels, okay? But they're surpassing you. And so, and the goal is that your grandkids would be like, this is second nature. This is just what Rigneys do. The idea that Rigneys wouldn't do that is just crazy, and so you're aiming for that, and you're just saying, okay, I can't snap my fingers, but I can be faithful in little and sow seeds, and trust God, and move it forward one generation at a time.
Okay, we'll end on this one. What advice would you give to a young man despairing of finding a wife to fulfill his leadership mandate?
Despairing. What did I say? I think that there's an issue. I find that it's often more the ladies that are in more of the despairing position. It's harder, both because sometimes there's an asymmetry between men and women. Men's eligibility and the thing that women are after, you continue to grow in as you get older. Okay, so what do women want? What do women want? Women want security, stability. They want power, strength, protection. Here's a dude, and he's going to be faithful. And so as you're 21 and you're like, I don't have much to offer in these areas, but by the time you work hard and you're stand up straight and you go, by the time you're in your 30s, you're actually increasing, right? You have more wealth, more authority, more power, and that's attractive. Okay, whereas women have the opposite issue, is the thing that's, what draws men's eyes? Beauty and charm, which they have in spades when they're younger and that diminish over time, even if their godliness increases. And so as they age, this is why the feminist lie is so insidious here, because what it does is it tells women that in the time when you're in your prime to draw the eyes of men in order to secure a godly husband, we want you to forego that and go corporate. Go corporate. Put that off. Your prime childbearing years, put that off. You'll figure that out later. And then they end up in their mid-30s and desperate, and then looking forward with, it's more ominous. So with a guy, I kind of feel like, dude, you actually have much more going for you. And so it would be take responsibility where you are. So start where you are. Take responsibility. That's in your job. That's in your home. Be active. And then think about it this way. Objects in motion draw eyes. Objects in motion draw eyes. So before you're thinking, I want to find a wife. Okay, do you have a mission? Because what you're doing in terms of seeking a wife is you have a calling, and you want help. So I have this calling, and I'm looking for somebody to help me, but I'm in motion. She's not the end of the quest. At one level, we say kill the dragon, get the girl. But at the other level, you say I'm getting the girl so I can go kill the dragon. Right? I'm gonna go do the thing, and she's gonna help me do the thing. So objects in motion. So find a calling. If you're starting to get desperate, I would get with some older men and ask them to be brutally honest with you. Can you see anything in my life? Like, why? I've really struggled. And you should say, don't spare my feelings. Because oftentimes, we're Christians, we don't want to hurt people's feelings. And you need to find a guy that you trust and that you admire in your church. And you say, is there anything? And if he says, yeah, you act kind of effeminate. And you say, what? He didn't want to offend you. But you're giving him permission, like, say the hard thing. It's like, you know what? You act kind of soft in these areas, and I think you need to work on it, right? And so be willing to hear hard. Or, you know what? Honestly, you look a little lazy. It looks lazy, and women are not interested in lazy. Or, you know what? You smell funny. Like, whatever it is. Like, dude, I got to be honest. Like, my wife mentioned to me the other day that you smell funny. Like, whatever it is, I don't know. Like, it could be lots of stuff, but, like, get someone who's going to be brutally honest. If you are in the almost despairing point, like, you don't want people to be nice to you, and leave you in the stupid that you're in. Instead, you want people to be honest with you so that you can get out of the stupid and get in gear, and then once you, you figure out what her name is and go ask her. Take some initiative. I think it'd be another thing. My impression about guys, this generation of young men, is that oftentimes they're afraid to take the shot unless they know that they're going to make it. And I think you should have the mindset of, I'm going to take the shot, and if I get rejected, I'm going to say that's good. And the reason is if you go ask the girl out and she says no, but you're able to take it like a man and be like, okay, appreciate that. If she's not interested in that way, and you go, okay, great, I appreciate that, thanks a lot, and you just move on, there's actually a 90% chance that some other, either her or some other girl is going to go like, you know what, he wasn't devastated by that, he wasn't awkward about it, he just moved on, that's actually a man. Maybe I'll give him a shot. So be that kind of guy, not afraid of rejection, but views it as a risk worth taking.
Well, brothers, can we give our Thanksgiving to Dr. Rigney?